what actually happens when the mind cognizes an object is not, again, a matter of easy comprehension. A sudden miraculous trick, as it were, takes place when there is a mental cognition and we are suddenly tripped from our balance and caught in a condition which escapes notice and eludes understanding. The cognition of an object is a miracle by itself. It is a wonder. And therefore it is not easy of comprehension. The peculiar structure called the mind envelops the shape of the object which is what is called as vyapti in Sanskrit. And they have given various examples to explain what sort of enveloping takes place. They say, as molten lead cast in a crucible may take the shape of the crucible, or water flowing into a field may take the shape of the field, circular or rectangular or square, or as the field is. The mind takes the shape of the object, and something else happens at the same time, which is the cause of our bondage. The mind does not merely stop with this act of enveloping the object. It drags our consciousness with it. Just as when a wife goes, the husband also goes. This is a danger in all mental cognitions. If the wife starts quarreling with somebody, the husband runs and starts adding to the quarrel. He makes it much worse. This is what happens. So if the mind merely envelops the object, so much the worse for us. But something still more undesirable takes place. That is, the consciousness is pulled together with this rush of the mind towards the object. And it is not merely the mind that is there in the object, we are there in the object. I am there in the object. Finished. My doom has come immediately. When I run from myself and sit on the object outside, you can imagine my condition. I forget myself, lose myself, snatch myself away from myself. And completely destroying my subjectivity, my self-identity, my very existence, I sell myself to the object. So that I have abolished myself like a slave, surrendering himself to the master under utter abnegation. The subject has become the object. This is an extreme form of clinging to objects. Why does the subject cling to the object? The subject has lost itself completely, lost its very life. It does not anymore exist there. It has transferred its location to that of the object. It is sitting in the object and has become the object. It has taken the shape of the object, identified itself with the object. Its existence is the existence of the object. It thinks through the object. Finished. this is the last consummatory condition to which the mind takes us in cognitions of objects. But there are stages of this process. This finally does not come about at once. The extent of absorption of the subject in the object depends upon the extent of the meaning that the subject reads in the object, the extent of the value that one sees in the object, the extent of the need one feels for the object. So, according to the degree of the value that is recognized in the object, to that degree one transfers oneself to that object. And so, there are degrees of affection. All affections are not same. You may have a little love or a little more love or intense love or completely self-abrogating love. In very rare cases, the ultimate stage comes. But mostly it is only some percentage of love. You have a love for your cat, you have a love for your puppy, you have a love for your dog, you have a love for your children, and so on and so forth. But all loves are not same. They have various degrees. In accordance with the meaning that you find in them, the value that is there, and the significance that you can read in their very existence in respect of your personal necessities. But now we are discussing merely the psychological processes of perception. And the subject about which I was mentioning, which is supposed to transfer itself to the object, is not merely a process of thinking. When I say the mind transfers itself to the object by an act of enveloping, it does not mean that merely a thought process in the ordinary sense takes place. Because the subject, the cognizing individual, is not merely thought but also will and emotion. Thinking, feeling and willing, these three are the primary functions of the psychological organ. So, in a cognition, it is not merely the thinking aspect that functions, though that is perhaps the first aspect that rouses itself into activity in cognition. Emotion follows. It is very difficult to withdraw emotion from acts of cognition. In some cognitions, emotions are not involved very much. Just as when you see a rock on the bank of the Ganga, there is a mental cognition based on sensory perception of that rock on the bank of the river. But as the rock does not mean much to you, whether it is there or it is not there, it is not of great significance to your life. Your emotions do not run to that rock. But if it is a rock of gold or a diamond, then the emotions will go. Oh, it is diamond rock. You will not withdraw your eyes from that. Go on looking at it. Because a tremendous meaning has been seen in that rock. But ordinary rocks do not mean anything. What is there, let it be there. We have seen so many rocks. But the control of the mind, which is the primary function in yoga, is also a direct step taken in the restraint of emotion and will together with thinking. Because while thinking is the beginning of attachment, the identification of the subject with the object, the will and the emotion get the upper hand subsequently and reinforce this act of cooperation and make it impossible for the individual to extricate itself from the identification it has established with the object. We cannot ordinarily understand to what extent we are attached to objects because we are shifting the position of attachment from one object to another every day according to circumstances. We do not stick to any particular object from morning to evening. That is not possible because we don't find it necessary. There are many factors necessary to maintain our individuality in life. A single object is not adequate. And so the mind in its intelligent maneuvers shifts itself suddenly like a shuttle from one center to another and keeps itself in contact with all the necessary factors in life which are essential for its existence and security. Just like a good politician who is shrewd enough to maintain his contact with all persons concerned with his security, his position, etc. He can contact even 1,000 persons in a day if necessity arises, by phone, by telegram, by letter, by personal interview, etc., etc. Because he knows that these contacts are necessary for his security and his status. Likewise, the mind, the greatest of politicians conceivable in the world, plays the very same trick and sees that its security is maintained throughout life and nobody threatens its existence. And the act of mental cognition is nothing but a continuous activity engaged in by the mind for maintaining its security in life. Otherwise, what is the use of perceiving things? Why do you want to see objects? Why do you want to contact people in the world? Why do you want friends? Why do you want telephones? It is only for security, maintenance, status, so that you may not be cut off from the ground on which you are standing. This is what the mind is doing in every act of cognition. Now, this is a bare outline of the psychological process involved in perception. But it is a process which completely enslaves us into conditions which go beyond our control. And you can imagine the state of affairs in which a bond slave lives. You must have heard of slaves in ancient history. Nowadays we don't have slaves of that kind. The slaves are sold not only financially, economically, but even emotionally and in every aspect that constitutes their personality. A slave is one who has no individuality or personality of his own. He has become part and parcel of the master to whom he has been sold. His existence, his will, his thought, his feeling, his very security and life itself is in the hands of the master. So is the case with an individual selling itself to the object. The object controls you and you are a slave of that object. Now one cannot know that one is a slave. In the case of mental attachments, the situation is a little different from a human slave selling himself to a master. The slave in the ordinary case, may be aware that he has bound himself to a master who is controlling him in every way. So he may be feeling very unhappy sometimes. Oh, what a condition is mine. I am serving under this master, and he may even remove my life due to the subjection into which I have entered with him. But here something worse is taking place in our case. We cannot be aware that we are slaves. We will not be sorry that we are attached to objects. We are immensely happy because of the attachment. Otherwise, how can there be attachment if we are always conscious of the sorrow that is involved in it? The attachment becomes a source of happiness. It is not a source of sorrow, as in the case of the ordinary slave or subordinate. It is a source of happiness because something very strange has taken place in the cognition of the object, which is the cause of the joy. Something inscrutable is taking place. The mind feels a need. That is the need which the whole personality feels. Why the need is felt is a little difficult to understand for surface thinking merely. The need is biological, sociological, psychological, economical, and every blessed. When you are attached to something, you are not attached merely for one single reason. Many factors pull you to the object. And all these factors act simultaneously so that you may not know what is happening to you. Like enemies attacking from all sides. You become helpless and then surrender yourself. So the subject surrenders itself to the object on account of the attack to which it is subjected by umpteen factors from all sides, as I mentioned, social, physical, economical, psychological, emotional, volitional, and what not. The need that we feel in our personality is multifaceted. This is what keeps us unhappy throughout the day. And to remove this unhappiness, we cling to objects. We feel social insecurity, physical deformity, emotional lack, and psychological inferiority, all at which cannot be set right at one stroke by a single object. It is difficult to find a single object which will fulfill all your needs, economical, sociological, physical, biological, etc. All these needs cannot be fulfilled by a single object. Such a thing is difficult to find. Maybe, such a thing may be there, but it is not easy to find always. So we cling to many aspects of objectivity for the fulfillment of various types of need we feel in our personality. We want social status, we want a big chair, we want recognition by people, we want a lot of money, we want a wife or a husband, we want a very delicious dish to take every day, we want a nice bed, and we want security by army, police and friends, etc., so that somebody may not attack us. We want medicines to cure us of illness. What untold things we require to keep us happy and secure in life. So, it keeps us distracted. The mind shifts itself from one thing to another thing to find out what it lacks and where it can find what it needs. But occasionally, it gets caught up by a preponderance of a type of need to the exclusion of others. That is what is called a mania, or an intense form of emotional clinging, rarely taking place, of course, in people, but not unseen. It can be the state of affairs of any person under certain conditions, where exclusive attachment is possible. Closing one's eyes to all other aspects of one's existence. When you are about to be elected into a very high post and you are working day and night, sweating and moving earth and heaven for this purpose, you may have an exclusive concentration on that aspect of your life, oblivious of every other fact. You may not eat. You see, hunger also goes at that time. Though at other times you may be very much thinking about the food that you have to take, at the election period you will not eat food. Where goes the hunger? Because there is a shifting of emphasis on some other aspect. You won't sleep also. Sleep is a necessity, but during election time, no sleep. There is no food. And there is no other biological attachment which can be usually there in family life or social life. That also is cut off. It is not cut off, but it is completely suppressed by the preponderance of an urge which has taken upper hand at that particular moment. Or when you are in an army, in a battlefield, where you are worked up into a feeling of intense emotion, do or die, you will find that all other needs are suppressed and a particular aspect of your mind gains its upper hand and directs you along a single channel. In the practice of yoga, we have to place ourselves in a practical condition by deliberate analysis and subject ourselves to diagnosis and treatment deliberately, voluntarily, for the purpose of freeing ourselves from chances of getting caught by these conditions in future, sometime or the other. Self-analysis is something like a vaccination, where you produce an artificial disease in your personality in order to get rid of the impending destructive disease which may threaten you. Though you may not be in a state of attachment just now, you become conscious of the possibility of such attachments in the future. Because no one can be completely immune to attachments of any type. Any attachment can come to any person at any time, only if circumstances are favorable. So we should not say we are free from these things. Nobody can be free. That you are free from certain attachments is only because of the fact you have laid emphasis on certain other factors for other reasons. Which does not mean that the enemy is not lying in the ambush, though he is not visible now. Anything can happen at any time to any person. We should not forget this. So we have to be cautious of these possibilities and then rouse the potentialities of the mind in this connection up from the unconscious level and even the subconscious, and then bring to the conscious level of direct attack and frontal investigation. This is self-analysis. So, to revert to the point I mentioned earlier, in the act of mental cognition, the mind takes the shape of the object and drags the consciousness towards it. In technical Sanskrit language, these are called vritti-vyapti and phala-vyapti. Vritti-vyapti is the enveloping by the mind of the object and taking the shape of the object. The molten metal getting cast into the crucible of the structure of the object. But to become conscious of it is to be in the state of phala-vyapti, as they call it. So there is a dual role played in acts of perception and cognition, psychological and conscious. And they are inseparable. The mind cannot be isolated from the consciousness that is animating it. Just as when a mirror is kept in the blazing sun, may itself become invisible. A glass that is in the sun cannot be seen because of the light of the sun shining through every particle of glass. The whole glass or mirror is radiant with the blazing light of the sun. and therefore you see only the glare and you cannot see the mirror there. Though it is there, it cannot be seen because the light has enveloped every particle of that matter. Likewise, you cannot know that some peculiar perceptional involvement is taking place on account of consciousness enveloping every fiber of thinking. You may say the mind is something like a mirror. Sometimes you may call it a prism. Sometimes you may call it a plain glass. Or it may be called a stained glass, through which consciousness passes like light and takes various shapes. And inasmuch as consciousness envelops the total structure of the mind in acts of mental activity, we cannot isolate ourselves from perceptual processes. We become the process. We become the process and we become the object towards which the process is directed, and we are the object. Samsara is subject becoming the object. Moksha is object becoming the subject. To put it very plainly, when you have become the object, you are a samsari. When the object has become you, you are liberated. Well, these are simple things to explain and say, but most difficult things to swallow. Because the mind is not an object of our perception as we have been noticing in our earlier analysis. It cannot be studied in the usual manner because here we are studying our own self, and so every act of self-control or mental control involves subjugation of oneself by oneself. Atma vinigraha is another word which is very aptly used in this connection. You control the self, which means yourself as you are at present, by introduction of the principles governing the higher values of life or the higher nature of the self. The higher self includes the immediate vicinity of objectivity, which usually the individual self regards as external to it. And every stage of rise to the higher degree of self is also a rise to a greater inclusiveness of objectivity in subjectivity, so that in every higher stage the subject becomes larger in its comprehension and objectivity gets lessened. The more you rise higher, the less is the objectivity involved in awareness and the greater is the subjectivity. So that in the final consummation, which is the goal of life, there is only subject and no object. All the objects are drawn into the subject in a largest comprehensiveness of the subject. That supreme subjectivity, which is all comprehensiveness, in which every object is consumed, is Ishvara or God. Hari Om Tat Sat. Krishna Bhagavan Ki Jai.